Weddings are beautiful things. Does anyone agree with me on that statement? Weddings are beautiful things. Yes. Okay, call me sappy or emotional. You can take my man card right now if you want to. I love a good wedding. So much planning and preparation and work goes into those 30 to 35 or 60 to 65, depending upon who you ask to do your charge, right? And it all pays off, doesn't it? I mean, the guy looks good, the girl looks good, everything looks great. Believe it or not, I loved my own wedding. It's wonderful. Beth spent months planning the perfect day, and she thought through colors and flowers and music and food and location, and she planned just a wonderful day. And I know this may be hard to believe, but this was before the days of Pinterest, so she pulled off an amazing feat, right? Everything went off exactly as planned. Almost everything, actually. At the end of the ceremony, when it was time to leave, our ring bearer fell face first down 6 stairs. It's on the video, too. We've rewinded it a couple times just to watch that whoop all the way down. Our flower girl, instead of taking her flower basket down the aisle on the recessional, she grabbed a hymnal and walked out with that, which would have been fine, except she discovered it midway down the aisle and turned around, sprinted back, got her flower basket, returned the hymnal, and kept on going out the auditorium. Pretty awesome. And then on our way out, we did sparklers, and we had so many sparklers that we lit outside that the smoke from the sparklers got caught in the intake for the building, and our whole reception hall filled with smoke on our send-off. It's awesome, awesome. So much planning goes into weddings, doesn't it? Just to make it the perfect day. And today, more than ever, brides love to have as much control as possible over their day, don't they? In fact, one company has made it their personal quest to ensure that everything about a couple's day can go exactly as planned, even down to stopping the rain. Nobody wants this on their wedding day, do they, John and Monica? Actually, it was wonderful. But there is a company in London that has made it their quest to stop rain for couples on their wedding day. It's a company named Oliver's Travels. And as of early 2015, they published this statement on their website. "We can now offer our customers a cloud-bursting service that can 100% guarantee fair weather. The service employs the talents of pilots and meteorologists who use silver iodide to seed the clouds, essentially giving the water vapor something to condense on and produce rain before the wedding day. And for $150,000, you can control one more aspect of your special day. Save now, ladies. We are a people who love our control, don't we? I've got it, Daddy, my 2-year-old son tells me as he struggles to wrestle both of his legs out of one side of his pants. I've got it, the teenage girl says, who is definitely old enough to handle a boyfriend right now. I've got it, says the 16-year-old as he grips the wheel of his dad's car for his first driving lesson. I've got it, we think, as a coworker leans in to explain a better way to organize the report we just spent 4 hours on. Or I've got it, we mumble to ourselves as our spouse explains to us the right way to fold the towels so that they fit into the closet. I may have just seen a nudge. We love our control. I've got it, we think, as we struggle to keep together our relationships and our grades and our jobs and our finances and our health and our comfort and our successes and keep everything right where we want it. And it is to that world of rugged control that James speaks this morning. And though this passage was written 2,000 years ago to a group of sea traders, probably. That's what commentaries think that this was addressed specifically to, was sea merchants on the Mediterranean Sea, businessmen. It's as if you can hear James speaking directly to our day today. I mean, it's as if he peeled back the curtain on Western culture and was able to say, this is going to be the problem that you need to focus on. So if we were to stand in the heart of Forbes magazine's best state for business for the third year in a row, which we are doing, in the middle of the downtown of a city on the rise that's catching the world's attention because of how successful we seem to be in so many areas, we would see over and over again the first sentences of our chapter played out, wouldn't we? Would you look at it with me? James 4, verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. That sounds like really good plans, doesn't it? I mean, that sounds like he's thought things through. He's got an idea of what he wants to do. Schedules, places, plans, goals, outcome, confidence, bravado, a little bit of swagger. We will make a profit. Today or tomorrow, it doesn't really matter which day we go, we're going to leave. And we're going to go to this or that town, again, inconsequential, really. We're going to spend a year there. The whole year will be at our disposal. And when we get there, we're going to trade, and those trades are going to make us money, and we're going to be rich. So much confidence. You can almost hear, we've got this. You can almost hear it in the plans. But there's a problem, isn't there? There's a problem. Something is missing. You search it and you see great plans. There's so much confidence, so much well-laid ideas, but so little God. Right. Take heed, James says, when you find your confidence in your control over your life. That's what James is after today. Take heed, James says, when you think you decide when and where and what and how things will turn out. Take heed when you find confidence in your plans and your abilities, so much so that you forget God. Look at verse 16. As it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. So what's the problem with this pursuit of control? What is it? You tell me. It's one word. It plagues us so often. What's the problem? It's pride, isn't it? It's pride. It's arrogance. It's boasting. Yes, we may be plotting a huge city of success for ourselves under our perceived control, but with every brick that we lay in the wall of that city, we do evil. With every brick that we lay of our city of success under our own control, we build a wall between us and God, don't we? Because we've already learned it in the chapter. Grace flows to the humble. Whoever would make himself a friend of the world is an enemy of God. God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And James points out another area of our life where we struggle with pride. So I wonder if you listened to your thoughts and plans over the last week, how you thought about what you were going to do and what you're looking forward to, how many of them would reflect what James says in verse 13? Come now, you who say this fall or next spring, I'll go to such and such a town and I'll spend 4 years there and I'll get a degree and I'll graduate with honors. come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, I'll go to such and such a town and get a job and save money and buy a house and someday retire with time to travel. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we'll get married and spend 3 or 4 years together, just the two of us. And then have 3 children spaced out 2.5 years apart, because we've really thought about that and that's the best thing to do. One more. Come now, you who say, this year or next, we will become a great church. We'll plant another church. We'll add more people and pastors and deacons and leaders, and we will be successful. Oh, may we all hear the words of James this morning. All such boasting is evil. I wonder, do you feel the temptation to entrust yourself to your own plans this morning? Do you feel the pull of your pride calling you to trust in your own control? I've got this. James has a word for us this morning. And in our text today, he's going to expose how dangerous that temptation actually is. How dangerous it is to live under the myth of control. And he's going to show us the way out of it. He's going to show us the way of escape, and that's the message today. And if you've been following this chapter so far, as you've been following its twists and turns, you actually already know the answer to what the escape is from the temptation to build our life on our own control. What is it? It's humility, isn't it? I even put it on the screen for you. Okay. It's humility. Grace flows to the humble. Humble yourself. But what does that mean? Because I don't know if you've noticed this. Humility is a very difficult thing to describe. Okay. Have you had any trouble thinking through and applying humility to your own life over the last few weeks here? Anybody struggle that way? Because can you ever really know if you're humble? You know what I'm saying? Like, if you think you're humble, are you really humble? I mean, if you're sitting in community group this Wednesday night and it's time for testimonies and you say, you know, I just feel like, I don't know, man, I really just feel like I'm growing in my humility right now. Are you though? Like, did you just brag about humility? I mean, it's difficult to wrap our minds around. It's slippery, isn't it? So what James does in this text is he's going to make us extremely practical for a little bit. He's going to help us see exactly what humility looks like. He's going to show us, okay, this is what it looks like right here. I'm going to zoom in on a very practical area of your life, how you view the future. So here's what humility looks like. This is what should be evident in your life when you plan and think about the future. And so the big idea James wants to walk through today is this. When you think about the future, you must humble yourself. Humble yourself when you think about the future. And he's going to show us 3 ways that we humble ourselves. Because when we talk about humility, James is going to show us a dimension to it that we don't often think about. Oftentimes when we think about humility, we think about Eeyore.
Just humble, I guess. I don't know. Just woe is me.
It's just like utter lowliness of mind where we just put ourselves down constantly. And some of you are very gifted at that, okay? But that's not the humility that James describes here. Humility isn't this woe is me thinking lowly of ourselves. Humility is simply thinking accurately about ourselves. It's actually acknowledging what is true about us and living in light of it. And so that's what James is going to walk us through today. Acknowledge what's true about yourself when you look at the future. Acknowledge these 3 things, because acknowledging these 3 things is the path to humility when you think about the future. So let's begin with the first area, the first thing we must acknowledge, and it comes in verse 13. He tells us, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such and such a town, spend a year there and trade and make a profit, yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. Humble yourself when you think about the future by, first of all, acknowledging your ignorance. This is not insulting. This is simply true, okay? Acknowledge your ignorance. No truer words could be said of the human condition when thinking about the future than verse 14. You do not know, right? And humility acknowledges the spiritual reality that we are not omniscient. We do not know everything. In fact, we are ignorant. So just for a second, would you reflect with me on what you do not know? None of us could have written ourselves into this room 10 years ago, could we? None of us. This church did not even exist 5 years ago. It was just 1 year ago this last month that we purchased this building and occupied it. Oh, my friends, there's a lot we don't know. But James isn't even talking about years here. He's talking about tomorrow. You don't even know what tomorrow will bring. And I think he's actually being quite generous, isn't he? Like, we don't even know what today will bring. I don't even know what this moment will bring. You definitely don't know what this tall, lanky guy is going to do with his arms for the next 30 minutes. We do not know. Oh, we have plans. We've got day planners, and we like to fill them out. We have ideas of what we'd like to do. And James isn't condemning those, okay? So if you are an anti-planner, some of you are extremely excited about this message right now. You're thinking, man, this is awesome. I don't plan, and God tells me that I don't even know, so here we go. And you're going to have conversations with your wife, and suddenly I'm going to be in the middle of it, and no, okay? No, that's not what James is saying, right? He is not condemning planning here, okay? If we were able to look through the book of Proverbs, we'd see over and over again that the Bible tells us that planning is actually very good for us. It's wise. Proverbs 21:5, the plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty, who doesn't plan, comes only to poverty. Proverbs 24:27, prepare your work, get everything ready for yourself, and after that, build your house. A prudent man gives thoughts to his steps, Proverbs 14:15. But in all our plans, we must remember this proverb. Commit to the Lord whatever you do, and your plans will succeed. Oh yes, plan. Make plans. But don't put your rest in those plans. Instead, acknowledge your ignorance and seek the Lord. I mean, I have plans for what's going to happen immediately after this service. I'm going to talk to some of you. I'll get to know some people who've been here for the first time. So glad you're here. And then I'm going to go home. And I already saw it in the crock pot. My wife has cooked something wonderful, and I can't wait to eat it. And I plan to sit down at the table with my family and enjoy a peaceful meal, reflecting on what God has given us today in our worship at Gospel Grace. And after it, the kids will display their love and respect for their mom and dad by quietly laying down for their mid-afternoon nap. And I plan to have plenty of time to trim my sermon down, to get ready for the youth service this afternoon, to the time allotted. I won't be rushed to get there. I'll enjoy that service, and then I'll come home to a quiet night with my family, enjoying the beautiful weather. You know what? That could happen. Or none of it could happen. I don't know any of it. I mean, some of those things are a little bit more likely to happen than others, but truth be told, I really have no idea, and neither do you. Would you heed the wisdom of Solomon again? Proverbs 28, verse 1. Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring. And this thought just flies in the face of the world we live in, doesn't it? We live in one of the most information-rich ages ever. Right? And that thing behind me just represents the access and power that all of us have with just a few keystrokes. We can find out anything about anyone, anytime. Sometimes too much, right? Like, have you ever Googled a skin issue you're having? Just don't, okay? Doesn't go well, right? But all of that access to information and that ease and that power that we feel tempts us to think that the more we know, the better we can plan and the more secure we are, doesn't it? But that isn't the way that God designed you. God designed you to acknowledge your ignorance. And he's intentionally wired you for ignorance. He doesn't want you to think that satisfaction comes from what you can understand. He doesn't want you to think that satisfaction comes from what you know. You will not be happy if you have all the answers. You will only be happy if you have the Lord. He's the only one who has the answers, and he offers them through his wisdom to those who seek him. You see, satisfaction goes much deeper than our knowledge and understanding. Satisfaction is our connection to the one who has all knowledge and all understanding. We will never fully understand. We will never cease to be ignorant. But that's okay. It's okay. Would you just breathe for a second? It's okay to not know how your kid is behaving right now. It's okay that you don't know, because God is your rest. And if God is your rest, you can live in the middle of your I do not know what tomorrow will bring ignorance and still be at rest. So just in this moment, would you just breathe this prayer with me? Lord, I do not know, but you do. Help me to find my rest in you. I wonder, have you embraced your ignorance? Humble yourself when you think about the future by acknowledging your ignorance, James tells us. But not only that, we keep reading verse 14. You do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. The second thing James wants us to notice about humility is this. Humble yourself when you think about the future by acknowledging your frailty. Acknowledge your frailty. Not only is there a lot we do not know, there is a lot we cannot do. We may think we are powerful. We may think we will live forever on this earth, but we will not. Our lives are short and frail. He says they are a mist. Our lives are as short and powerless as the mist that rises off a warm lake on a cold morning, only to be chased away by the heat of the sun just a few minutes later. You don't get shots like that very often. Do you know why? Because that moment will pass like that. James says, that is your life. I mean, just give yourself a test. Give yourself a test. How many of you, this is the easy part, how many of you can name your parents' first and last names? Would you raise your hand? Great. Most of you? Wonderful. Some of you weren't listening. That's okay. Let's go a little harder. How many of you can name your grandparents, all your grandparents? There might be more than four. There might be a bunch, okay? How many of you can name the first and last names of your grandparents? Raise your hands. Okay, keep them up. All right, put your hands down. How many of you can name the first and last names of all of your great-grandparents? Okay. Do you realize that was just a few decades ago that they were on this earth? Their hearts were pumping. They were breathing. They were talking. They did stuff. But it's a reminder that all of us in the room this morning are a mist that appears for a moment and then vanishes away. So acknowledge your frailty, right? That's humility. I mean, it's the truth, so we should acknowledge it. And again, this flies in counterculture to our age. This is not normal. Our age pressures us to spend enormous amounts of thought and energy trying to make something of our mist. Make something of your mist. Make it look like something better than it is. Make your mist last. And, you know, there's tons of poetry and songs that are written about this. I could reference Ozymandias. Go check it out today, okay? It's a great refrain of this thought. But you know what I got lost in? I got lost in the poetry of the great Cassius Clay. You might know him as Muhammad Ali. Okay. He was well known for this poetic, prophetic trash talk. He would try and prophesy of what round he would defeat his opponents. He'll be mine in round 9. He'll fall in 8 to prove that I'm great. If he makes me sore, I'll cut it to 4. If that don't do, we'll get him in 2. He's been called the greatest trash talker of all time. He said this, "I'm not the greatest, I'm the double greatest. Not only do I knock him out, I pick the round. I'm the boldest, the prettiest, the most superior, most scientific, most skillfulest fighter in the ring today. I've wrestled with alligators, I've tussled with a whale, I've done handcuffed lightning and thrown thunder in jail. You know I'm bad. Just last week I murdered a rock. I injured a stone. I hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick." I'm not a mist. I'm the greatest. Well, James has some poetry of his own in today's verse. He says, "We are a mist that appears for a moment and then vanishes away." And if we were to look in the original language at those words, appear and vanish, we'd see that they came from the same root word. In other words, if you were reading it in the Greek, you would hear this repeated sound. We've actually got two words that sound just like it in the English. Appear and disappear. In other words, your life is just like when the waves of the Mediterranean crash into the rocks and a mist appears only to disappear with little to show for a short time. You appear and you disappear with very little to show. You're like your breath on a cold morning is there for a half second. It appears and then it disappears. Your life is a mist. But we don't live like that is true, do we? Sure, Muhammad Ali said it out loud, but a lot of us live it in our hearts, don't we? All of life becomes this prize fight where we have to make something of our mist. My grades have to be better. My parenting has to be better. My performance at work has to be better. My car has to be better. My bank account has to be better. My life on this earth has to be better. No, James says, you are a mist. You appear and you disappear. Humility acknowledges that. Acknowledge your frailty. This kind of teaching is all over the rest of our Bibles. We read some of it this morning from Psalm 39. O Lord, make me to know my end and what is the measure of my days. Let me know how fleeting I am. Behold, you've made my days a few handbreadths, a handbreadth. And my lifetime is as nothing before you. Surely all mankind stands as a mere breath. Surely a man goes about as a shadow. Or Psalm 90. Teach us to number our days, that we may get a heart of wisdom. So what we do on this earth with the short breath that we have is only preparation for the grand reality that is eternity. So acknowledge your frailty and live in light of it. This is not a time to whip out your resume. It's not a time to start actually trying to combat what James is saying. Oh, no, you don't know how strong I am, actually. You don't know. You know, what do you do to get hired these days? What do? You lay out a resume and you list all of your strengths, don't you? I've done this and that. I mean, basically, I'm the best thing you've ever seen. I know everything and can do anything, right? And you include all these keywords that you want your resume to rise to the top. You've got such a strong portfolio, such a strong set of experiences, such a strong knowledge of the company that you just read about in Google for 5 minutes before the interview, such a strong potential. That's not how it works with God. That's not the life of wisdom. Your resume has one line on it. I am a mist. I won't be here long and I can't accomplish much. Acknowledge your frailty. I mean, even Muhammad Ali, at the end of his life, acknowledged his frailty. Do you know what he said? When his body was racked with Parkinson's, he said this, "The things that once were so effortless, my strong voice and the quickness of my movements are now much more difficult." Maybe my Parkinson's is God's way of reminding me of what is important. It slowed me down and caused me to listen rather than talk. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Humility, when we look at the future, is acknowledging that we are frail. Lord, our short, weak life in this world is only preparation to be with you. May I humbly acknowledge my frailty so that I can embrace the strength that you offer me through your Son. But James goes on. There's another aspect to humility that he wants to draw out for us. How do we humble ourselves when we think about eternity? Well, we acknowledge our ignorance. There is a lot we do not know. We acknowledge our frailty. What are we? What is our life? It's a mist. We are a mist that appears and then disappears. But verse 15 says this. Instead of saying proudly that you have control over your life, verse 15, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. Oh, my friends, humble yourself when you think about the future by acknowledging your dependence. Acknowledge your dependence. When we start to understand our frailty and our ignorance, it leads us to one conclusion, and that is this: everything about our life comes to us only if the Lord wills. Everything. There isn't a single thing we can do that falls outside of needing God for our very life. We need him for everything. And simply put, James tells us, here's how we acknowledge our humility in this way. We say, if the Lord wills. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills. That phrase is very common in our New Testament. So we actually hear the Apostle Paul saying, if the Lord wills, I will do this, over and over again. 18:21 of the book of Acts, Paul, he's leaving Ephesus and he says, I will return to you again if God wills. Paul believed in the sovereignty of God and he let it come out in the way he talked. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 19, he writes, I will come to you soon if the Lord wills. Philippians 2:19, it displays this. I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon. And I trust in the Lord that shortly I myself will come also. And in keeping with Paul's example, this has been something that the church has done through the ages when talking about the future, isn't it? And this is something that's been normal for the church to say. You've maybe even heard it before. Have you ever heard anyone say, Lord willing? Right? Anybody heard that before? Well, if the Lord wills, Lord willing. Yeah. And in various levels of formality, I came from a place of the country where people said, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise. Okay? Or if you're Puritan and you prefer the Latin, you would say the words, Deo volente. God willing. So if you want to sound smart today, okay, if you want to sound smart, just talk about your plans and then just finish it with a simple Deo volente. And then say, well, that just means Lord willing. And then confess your pride. Because that's what the message is about today. In fact, they actually got to using the phrase Deo volente so often that they actually just shortened it to DV. So D period, V period. A lot of Puritans and even early Methodists would sign their letters with their name at the bottom and then DV, Deo volente, Lord willing. So their letters were full of this. They would even put it on their advertisements for events at the church. So there would be a date and a time of an event, DV next to it. Deo volente, God willing. In other words, even as they publicized the event, they were publicizing a dependence and a submission to the Lord. We make these plans, but we depend on the Lord for everything about them. And we would do well to do the same. We make these plans, but we depend on the Lord for everything about them. We ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that. But James isn't giving us a magic word here, okay? So this isn't like a bibbidi-bobbidi-boop phrase that you can just pour on your proud planning and then it suddenly turns you into a humble person, okay? So you can't just use this like a Christian cliche and just like clean up the rest of your life. Well, I mean, John said that if the Lord wills, I'm just going to start saying that. I'm still going to be as proud as possible, but no, it's not a magic word. And it's also not a formula, okay? It's not like a formula that we have to say every single time we talk about the future. It's not a formula that if you fill it out, then you are not sinning. Okay? You don't always have to say, if the Lord wills. Some of you were pulling out a little DV squad badge and starting to shine it. Okay, you were going to be the Lord willing police of Gospel Grace Church, and you were ready to hold all of us accountable for this new information that we've learned. You know, like somebody finishes, well, I'm going to be going to lunch, Lord willing. Right? Just kind of slip it in there. Okay. The Apostle Paul himself didn't always use the phrase. Okay, so if you need a word to help protect you from the legalism of trying to judge everyone else in the congregation by whether or not they use the phrase, Lord willing, here it is. You ready? It's Romans 15:28. Okay, Romans 15:28. Here's your proof text for not needing to say Lord willing all the time. Paul is talking about his plans in the future indicative. Are you ready? Paul says this, I will leave for Spain. That's it. There you go. There he is, Paul, such a rank unbeliever, lacking trust in the Lord, planning without consulting the Lord's will. No, he's just talking like a normal human being. I mean, Paul submitted to the sovereignty of God. Read the rest of his literature. Paul was a man who lived under the sovereign hand of God in what he did. So no, James isn't telling us we have to say, Lord willing, every time we talk about the future. He's saying we have to think, Lord willing, every time we think about the future. This isn't so much about what we say, although that is very important, and it is actually a gift when you say, Lord willing, to another believer. It's a reminder. But James is not saying that we have to say, Lord willing, every time we talk about the future. He's saying we have to think it. He's after a heart that is so shaped by a functional, heartfelt, lived out dependence on the sovereign will of God that it can think of nothing apart from dependence on the Lord. If the Lord wills ought to be the beat of our heart when we look into the future. It ought to so fill our minds that we can think of nothing but resting completely on Him for our very breath. That's what he says. If the Lord wills, we will breathe. If the Lord wills, our heart will pump. If the Lord wills, our lungs will turn the oxygen that we suck into them into the proper things that will fuel our body. If the Lord wills, there is nothing that we can do that is outside of this phrase. This is huge. Isn't it? I know we're tempted to think that it's actually not that big of a deal. We're tempted to belittle it. It's just like if the Lord wills. I mean, are you kind of overstepping a little bit, John? You kind of reaching a little bit on this point? No, because I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, this is it's not a big deal. I just forgot to include God. Exactly, right? I mean, what James is revealing is that all too often, God is of such little importance in our lives that we forget to think about the very one who holds everything about our lives together. God didn't make us to live that way. He didn't make us to just do things and go places with our bodies. He made us to reflect what is true about life and Him when we do things and go places with our bodies. You weren't created just to go down to West Valley City and do some business. You were made to go down to West Valley City with thoughts and attitudes and words that reflect a wholehearted submission and dependence on God and do some business. Do you see the difference? You were made to reflect the Lord not just in your actions, but in how you think about your actions. You see, all of your life and all that you do comes from His will, for His will. Everything about you, if the Lord wills, it all comes from His will to be used for His will. If you are smart or if you aren't, who do you think put the brain in your head? If you're an athlete or you trip over yourself when you try to pick up a basketball, did you construct those muscle fibers? If you can sing or if you can't, did you engineer the vocal cords that vibrate when air goes over them? If you have a lot of energy or you don't, did you figure out your metabolism and make it balance? If you have a lot of experience and it's helped you to advance in your career, or if you've never had a job in your life that's helped, who did all of it? The Lord. You see, if the Lord wills, you are able to think and sing and play and work and live the way He wants you to, because it all came from His will to be used for His will. So acknowledge your dependence. Because it is then that we are able to pray the radical words of the Lord's Prayer. Your kingdom come, Lord. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Lord, in my marriage, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In my children's life, Lord, your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Lord, your kingdom come, your will be done in my singleness on earth as it is in heaven. Lord, your kingdom come, your will be done in my work tomorrow as I go to my job on earth as it is in heaven. Lord, your kingdom come, your will be done as I sit down in class as it is in heaven. I wonder, can you pray that prayer with a heart of faith, acknowledging your submissive dependence on the will of the Lord for everything about your life, because it is from His will and for His will that you have anything you have? Or are you a little bit anxious to pray that? A little bit worried because maybe there's something you want that you're afraid God will keep from you. Or maybe you're not sure that the sovereign will of the Lord of the universe will be enough for you. Oh, my friends, tucked into the phrase, if the Lord wills, is a dependent heart that is at rest in the all-wise and all-powerful God. Tucked away in that phrase, if the Lord wills, is a declaration of trust with joy and rest in the all-sufficient Lordship of Jesus Christ. You see, there is so much that we do not know and cannot do. There is nothing that your God does not know and cannot do. We are ignorant and frail. God is all-knowing and all-powerful. And so today, Lord, we acknowledge our dependence on You. If You will, we will live or do this or that. Humble yourself when you think about the future and acknowledge your dependence. But there's one more aspect that James throws in at the end that we're tempted to think is an afterthought. We're tempted to think this phrase has nothing to do with the previous context. But when we look deeper into it, we see that this is what it's actually all about. And it comes in verse 17. He says, so whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. There's one final aspect of dependence that we have to address. And I can think of no better conclusion to a message that we've listened to together for the last about 45 minutes than to say, you need to depend on the Lord, because knowledge alone is not enough. It's not enough for you to hear this truth and be done. Now that you know this truth, you are responsible for living this truth. So as a result of hearing God's word today, we are all responsible for speaking of the future differently than we used to. We now know better than to think and to plan as if God is not the one in charge, as if our plans don't depend on the will of the Lord. And to live any other way is a sin against the Holy God. And this is why it's so important to talk about dependence. This is why it's so important to acknowledge our dependence, because if we start to examine the things that we haven't done that we should have done, we begin to watch any claims of our own righteousness just begin to vanish before our very eyes, don't we? I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty good at keeping a list of rules of things I'm not supposed to do. I'm actually really good at judging myself based on how I'm doing at that list of rules. Well, I see them doing over there, that over there. I would never do that. And I find a form of self-righteousness and legalism in that. But James is very clear. Sin is also failing to do anything that we know we should do. To him who knows to do the right thing and fails to do it, to him it is sin. You see, sin in the Bible is described in this way. It's described as both doing something that God commands us not to do and also not doing something that he has commanded us to do. So, my friends, may we all acknowledge our dependence on the Lord for his grace, because there are many things that we know we should do that we do not do. Think of the times when you were silent when you should have spoken, when you could have served but you didn't, when you saw someone in need that you could have helped but you looked the other way, when you heard a false word and you said nothing, when you saw someone lonely or discouraged and you talked to your friend instead. Or in the immediate context of today's passage, think of when we know we ought to live with our every thought and action in submission to and in dependence on our supremely sovereign God, but instead we live like we've got it. What could be more sinful than the pride and arrogance of hearing God remind you that it is only if he wills that we live or do this or that, and then walking away and continuing to live as if we own our lives and we control our lives? See, when we understand this verse, we begin to see what a sweeping condemnation this is of our own self-righteousness. Our little sandcastles of obedience that we work so hard to construct just get washed away by our many sins, don't they? Oh, my friends, if you're hearing this today and you're feeling the conviction of the Lord on your heart, would you know something? You will only find mercy in dependence on him. You will not find mercy by trying harder. Your righteousness is not enough, and I think you know that. Your only hope is dependence on one who was completely righteous. You see, there was one. He came and he actually always did the Father's will. There was nothing that he should have done that he left undone. Even to the point of when he was in anguish in the garden and he was praying for another way than to have to die in sacrifice for his people. And do you know what he said in that moment? So connected to our text today. Not my will, but yours be done. If the Lord wills, I will go forward. And he did. And he went to the cross. And he bore the wrath of God, the punishment of God for sin that all of us deserved. And he died. But he didn't stay dead. The Bible tells us that he rose again. He came back to life and he offers in himself mercy and grace and forgiveness to any who would depend on him. That's what the word faith means. It simply means to depend on the Lord. And so for those who have not done what the law commands and those who have done what the law forbids, he offers forgiveness to you and you can accept it right now. So today, our only hope is humility. Humble yourself by acknowledging your dependence and confess with Paul that you have no righteousness of your own that comes from keeping a list of rules. Your only righteousness can be found in Jesus Christ. He is your hope today. Oh, my friends, when you think about the future, would you humble yourself? Would you acknowledge what is true? Because this kind of humility, the kind of dependence that is attached to it, it changes everything about us such that you are actually able to truly humble yourself. So that when you think and plan for the future, you think and plan with a heart full of gratitude for the great mercy that you've been given in Jesus Christ. such that you have a heart that's full of trust in God's infinite knowledge and his infinite power, and you think and you plan for the future with a heart of humility that acknowledges your ignorance, acknowledges your frailty, and acknowledges your dependence on the Lord for everything. I wonder, do we need to humble ourselves? May we all acknowledge what is true about us so that we might cling to what is true about God. Would you bow your heads with me?